Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 28th, 2019. Here in Northern California, we're drying out after another atmospheric river dumped its contents. I got over 9 inches of rain at our house in a 36-hour period. We've got some localized flooding, some roads are out, but other than that, we're doing okay. Donald Trump didn't get what he wanted from the summit with Kim Jong-un in Hanoi, Vietnam. And I don't have any real sharp criticism of Trump in this particular moment. I think that he has attempted to, after ginning up tensions with North Korea, with his name-calling and his brinksmanship a year and a half ago, he has attempted to conduct some diplomacy. And that's not his strong suit. He doesn't have the patience for all the details. He just wants a deal and a photo op. And a lot of people, including many Democrats, were predicting that he would give away the store in order to come away with some sort of a face-saving agreement and the photos that come with it. But after abruptly ending the talks and saying, well, we walked out, but we shook hands before we did, Trump is returning to the United States. He said it was about the sanctions. Basically, they wanted the sanctions lifted in their entirety, but we couldn't do that. He said that Kim had offered to dismantle the North's most important nuclear facility if the U.S. lifted the sanctions, but he wouldn't commit to do the same for other elements of the weapons program. And so it's clear that they were talking past each other. And I would suggest that they didn't allow the diplomat-level talks to reach a stage where a breakthrough in a one-on-one meeting might be possible. And so it's a lengthy process that hopefully will continue. And I have no objection to the fact that Trump has, in his own ridiculous way, found a path to get North Korea to suspend its missile tests and, if they can be believed, suspend further development of nuclear weapons. Now, we're told that they have 30 to 60 bombs and that they now have the missile capability to hit at least Hawaii, if not the continental United States. Now, one thing is pretty interesting because Kim Jong-un does not talk to media except his own state-controlled media in North Korea. And Trump hosted a press conference where he mostly called on non-American reporters, so he didn't get asked too many questions about Michael Cohen's testimony. And I'm sure it really drove Trump crazy. He said he was trying to watch as much of Cohen's testimony as he could, but that was on, kind of in the middle of the night, Vietnam time. So anyway, I first heard about this comment from Kim Jong-un, which is extremely rare. He answered a question by an American reporter who asked, "Are you ready to denuclearize?" And I first heard about this when the guy who is deaf because of his OxyContin problem, radio host Rush Limbaugh, mangled reporting on this. And to give a little benefit of the doubt to L. Rushbo, he is deaf, and he uses various techniques to put things, convert them to text so that he can read them and pretend that he can hear things. And the question by the American reporter and Kim Jong-un's answer were garbled by a lot of background noise. But what's critical is that Kim said, "If I'm not willing to do that," referring to denuclearization, "I wouldn't be here right now." Well, Rush reported it as, "I'm not willing to do that. I wouldn't be here right now," which, of course, didn't make any sense. But, rational understanding is not central to Rush Limbaugh's act. Today, in another rare moment, the foreign minister of North Korea, Ri Yong-ho, maybe it's Ri Yong-ho, held his own presser. And he said, "Wait a minute. Kim only asked for partial sanctions relief as a framework to move ahead with plans to dismantle North Korea's nuclear enrichment capabilities. He said the North sought an end to sanctions that hamper the civilian economy and the livelihood of all people in particular, but he didn't offer more details. So this confusion or misreading is something that is common with Trump's meetings with world leaders, like the blowback that he got after his one-on-one meeting with Vladimir Putin. And we often hear more accurate reports of these meetings from the foreign government's press operations than we do from our own. So, do you believe Trump or do you believe the North Korean clarification? I'm not sure. And my big disappointment is that there isn't a path to lay out an agreement, a peace treaty, to end the 1950s Korean War. I've said this many times, and I believe that that is the gracious way to engage in long-term talks with North Korea that could determine if they're serious about the offer to denuclearize. Now, one of the troubling things is that the Democrats, in their effort to be against almost everything that Trump stands for, they appear to be against peace on the Korean Peninsula. Nancy Pelosi tweaking Trump today in a way that I find unnecessary. Now, he is so gratuitous in his own attacks on other people that it's easy to be generous to people like Speaker Pelosi. But she was kind of gloating. I guess it took two meetings for him to realize that Kim Jong-un is not on the level. The prospect for success seemed dim in light of the insincerity of Kim Jong-un. And Pelosi also criticized Trump for comments in Hanoi at his news conference when he took Kim at his word that he would not have allowed the American college student from Ohio, Otto Warmbier, to be treated so poorly if he knew about his situation. Now, the family believes he was brutally tortured while imprisoned in North Korea and died shortly after his comatose form was returned to the United States. I'm not in a position to evaluate that. This is another case of Trump believing a dictator, which is a great opportunity for his opponents to score political points. And again, I would prefer to see a bigger picture development, like the start of peace talks around a treaty ending the 1950s Korean War. And I recommend to you a piece that I've linked to in the show file for today's podcast. I didn't see it until today, but it was published almost a week ago at The Nation by Tim Shorrock. Tim is an expert on Korea politics and the history there, and I've interviewed him several times on this podcast. And he notes that senior Democrats in the House and Senate, joined by a few Republicans, in advance of the summit, were sounding alarm bells, warning that the South Korean President Moon Jae-in is moving too fast in reconciling with North Korea. Now, I find this comical, to see Democrats line up and say, don't move too fast. I mean, this Cold War between the Koreas has been in place since 1953 or 1954. There is no risk of either nation going too fast in trying to soften the very tough relations that have existed between them. So I think Shorrock's piece is interesting. He writes, the congressional actions have been fueled by a steady stream of pessimistic and often misleading studies from Washington think tanks. And Senator Bob Menendez, who has no credibility, he's the New Jersey Democrat who is staunchly pro-Israel. He survived his own corruption trial narrowly last year. He joined with Ted Cruz in a letter to Trump attacking President Moon's push for closer economic ties with North Korea. And Menendez has backed it up with a resolution promoting the trilateral military alliance between the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, which is poison in Korea, and that's why it's being promoted. It's also being introduced in the House by the reliable neocon Democrat Elliot Engel, chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And so I find this interesting. The Democrats are saying, oh, we can't trust North Korea. And they do not want peace, or at least the exit of American forces from Syria, which they failed to authorize when Obama committed those forces there. They have no legal basis to be there. And while Trump has bungled his effort, and now he's leaving 200 American troops in one spot in Syria and 200 in another, a lot of that is because of the resistance from Democrats and deep staters. But they don't have any problem with Trump's saber-rattling and war drum escalation with Venezuela. Democratic policies are incoherent, in my humble opinion. Now we go to day two of Michael Cohen's testimony. He is back behind closed doors with an Intelligence Committee hearing today. But I got to watch most of, I recorded off CNN, and then I went to the C-SPAN replay, and I saw, I think, 70 or 80% of Cohen's testimony before the House Oversight Committee yesterday. And I still come away saying that while he is a creep who was loyal to a thug, Michael Cohen, I believe, told the truth. And the way the Republicans, they set it up so they had two attack dogs. Jim Jordan, the former Ohio State wrestling coach who was using WWF tactics yesterday to attack Michael Cohen, and his tag team attack dog partner was Mark Meadows, the Freedom Caucus guy and a Tea Party extremist. We'll get back to him in a moment. But basically, most of the Republicans were on message, reading denunciations of Cohen and the theatrics of the hearing. And when they finished, they would give their unfinished time to either Meadows or Jordan, who would continue to attack Cohen. And most of it was just smoke and bullshit. What was interesting, though, is that Cohen explicitly did not provide any proof that incriminates the president on possible collusion with Russia. He said he had no knowledge of any collusion. When pressed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, he kind of said, well, Trump would do anything to win, yeah. And that was so broad as to include some sort of a deal with Putin or Russian actors of some sort. But what we clearly saw is that Trump is vulnerable to obstruction of justice and the campaign violations related to the hush money payments. Those are all available to the Democrats. And when asked at his press conference in Hanoi, Trump said Cohen lied a lot. But, you know, the most important question up there was the one on collusion, and he said he saw no collusion. I was actually impressed that he didn't say there was collusion. He could have gone all out. He only went about 95%. He could have gone 100%. So, Cohen is a rat in the mob lingo, Trump speak, except when he provides information favorable to Trump. And that kind of selective blindness or deafness was exhibited by all of the Republicans on the committee yesterday, except for a couple of moments from Tom Massey and Justin Amash. And they were hardly pure in their kind of different approaches. And so, as I look at this, we have all the evidence necessary to impeach Donald Trump. And we'll get to the impeachment part here in just a moment. We have Jay Sekulow in the White House modifying Cohen's testimony, which he delivered and then pled guilty because it contained lies. That's conspiracy right there. It also, the hearing provided a way to get a look at some of the new members of Congress, including some Democrats, like Rashida Tlaib, a freshman from Detroit. And she accused Mark Meadows of presenting a racist message before the committee. She was very careful to avoid specifically attacking Meadows as a racist. But what prompted that was that after a lunch break, Meadows brought in Lynn Patton, an African-American woman who's in the Trump, I think, over at Housing and Urban Development, maybe. She's a family friend, And she has said she doesn't believe that Trump is racist. Now, Michael Cohen flatly said that Trump is racist and that what we've heard, well, he's actually much worse behind closed doors. So Tlaib said that using a black woman as a prop was racist in itself. And I congratulate her for confronting this issue right there. And the arcane rules of the Congress make it difficult for you to call out a member by name or specifically assert that they made a racist comment or presentation. But what was really disgusting is when the chair, Elijah Cummings, who is, as you probably know, African-American, he basically brokered a peace and just brushed aside the issue, said, oh, Ms. Tlaib, or Tlaib as he called her, didn't mean to call Mark Meadows a racist. Well, Mark Meadows, back in 2012, when he was campaigning on a Tea Party Express, this is the 9th of June, 2012, he said, we're going to take back our country. 2012 is the time. We're going to send Mr. Obama home to Kenya or wherever it is. And what came out is that Mark Meadows apparently has a son or daughter who married a person who isn't white. And he said, I have nieces and nephews or grandchildren of color. And then Elijah Cummings came to his defense. And he said that the two of them are really good friends. Now, I don't judge any friendships by members of different parties who serve in Congress. They can be friends if they want to be. But I think this compromised Mr. Cummings, who then nevertheless went on to deliver a blistering closing comment where he said, we're better than this, referring to the slime that had been displayed in the hearing. So, net-net, the bottom line is the Democrats are willing to investigate Trump almost every day, in almost every way. But they are afraid of impeachment. We'll get to that in just a moment. I want to mention that Cohen enumerated, under questioning, that in the 10 years he worked for Donald Trump, he threatened people. He bullied them repeatedly. And when asked how many times, I think Jackie Speer was the questioner, he stopped at 500. She said, was it 20 or 40? And he said, 100, 200. So he went up to 500 in his guesstimate of how many times he had threatened people, including the schools where Trump went, threatening if they somehow released his grades or his academic information, that they would be sued. And so Trump is, if anything, consistent. At that Hanoi news conference, he warned that fellow Republicans who vote to nullify his national emergency decree will be putting themselves at great jeopardy politically. And it appears they take that threat more seriously than they do the threat to our nation of his continuation as president, or the threat to their own political futures by staying loyal to him. That was the big takeaway that Cohen left them with yesterday. Look at me, he said. This is what you get if you're loyal to Trump. 3 years in the federal pen. Now to the impeachment issue being discussed today in the New York Times, where Michael Shear writes a news analysis piece, and he says that particularly Democrats will face a rising chorus from the liberal wing of the party to impeach Trump for what we believe is a clear case of a president who defrauded the public and, I'm adding this, obstructed justice. For Republicans, Cohen's allegations will once again require Trump's followers to decide how long they will stand by a president whose actions threaten not only his administration, but also the fate of politicians in the party he leads. I think I just said that. And Cohen, this is what I was referring to. I'm responsible for your silliness because I did the same thing that you're doing now for 10 years. I protected Trump for 10 years. I can only warn people. The more people who follow Trump as I did blindly are going to suffer the same consequences that I'm suffering. But the Republicans stuck to their talking points and just continued to attack him. Over at The Nation, my relentlessly optimistic pal John Nichols, who wrote a book about impeaching Bush and Cheney. He took a positive spin from this. He says no one should doubt that the testimony makes the case for impeaching and removing an unfit president. Well, Johnny, you and I fully agree on that. But I think he is too easy on the Democrats for their resistance. He makes a strong case. Cohen provided much more than an indictment of the president's character. He detailed wrongdoing that can and should form the basis for articles of impeachment. Well, Mr. Nichols, I fully agree, but the resistance is from the Democratic leadership, and Politico airs that out. All of these articles are linked in my show file for your easy linkage, and senior Democrats are wary of pursuing impeachment. Pelosi sidestepped questions about Cohen's testimony yesterday. I haven't seen one word of it referring to impeachment. If I have a statement, you'll be the first to know. Let me say this. I care a lot more about the bad policies of Trump than his bad personality. That is not the point. It's criminal behavior. Pelosi and the Democrats have been promoting the whole Russia telenovela for over 2 years now. That collusion, collaboration created this grave threat to our democracy. But they're willing to let him stay? When the Constitution provides the clear remedy of impeachment? Politico continues, so far Pelosi's largely been able to keep the caucus from erupting into a public brawl over impeachment. Despite the multi-million-dollar pressure campaign from Tom Steyer from here in San Francisco and increasing demands on the left to take action. And Chairman Cummings, quote, isn't it interesting that not one person on our side even mentioned the word impeachment? Well, I don't think that's interesting. I think that's disgusting. And Rashida Tlaib was edging up to it, building the case, talking about his criminal behavior. But she didn't say the I word. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who did a good job of questioning Cohen about the sweetheart deals, like the Amazon deal that she gets blamed for killing in Long Island, where Trump has a golf course that New York taxpayers subsidized with over $100 million. But she didn't mention removing the president, even though she was quoted saying that there's no question she would vote to impeach Trump if she's given the opportunity. And John Yarmuth, Democrat from Kentucky, chair of the House Budget Committee, talking about the recalcitrant leadership. Well, they don't feel that way yet, but we'll work on them. The evidence is pretty unambiguous, Yarmuth said. The president of the United States committed a crime while in office. He needs to be brought up for impeachment. Well, that's one voice. We need a couple of hundred more. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Alice Carlson, David Rabin just renewed his annual subscription, so did Eric Boll. And John Morgan kicks in $5 a month. It's coffee money. You can do it too. Just stop by at peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. In seconds, you'll be looking at the sign-up page where you can make an easy choice, $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription still offers you the bonus book of Dr. Justin A. Frank's Trump on the Couch. I'd love to send you a copy with your new annual subscription and a mailing address here in the continental U.S. Well, it appears that tensions between India and Pakistan are stabilizing, if not subsiding a little bit. The Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, announced Thursday his country will be releasing the captured pilot shot down from an Indian MiG that flew into Pakistani airspace. It's also been clarified that Pakistan only shot down one Indian fighter jet, not two, as I reported yesterday. Khan said, in our desire for peace, I announce that tomorrow we will be releasing the Indian Air Force officer who is in our custody. But on the other side of the border, India appears wary, and they want to continue the pressure, claiming that Pakistan can stop the kind of terrorist attack that took out some 40 Indian soldiers in Kashmir on the 14th of February. And in India, they suggest that Khan's move is an empty ploy, ignoring the real problem between the two countries. So we'll keep an eye on that one. From my perspective, this is very good news from Jerusalem. The Attorney General of the State of Israel, Avichai Mandelblit, has announced his plans to indict Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Now, the investigations have been underway for years now, 3 separate investigations and a 4th one that led to allegations that Mrs. Netanyahu had abused her position and soaked taxpayers for champagne and special dinners and things like that. But the charges against Bibi are very serious. They are in 3 categories: that Hollywood producer Arnon Milchan, aided by the Australian billionaire Jamie Packer, sent expensive cigars, jewelry, and champagne worth hundreds of thousands of dollars to the prime minister's residence. 2nd, Netanyahu accused of discussing with the publisher of a largest newspaper in Israel a deal for favorable coverage. And that Netanyahu had pushed regulatory actions through the communications ministry, arranging for fawning coverage of Netanyahu and his family. Now, this occurs just 40 days before the re-election that he called, and will it cause his downfall? That remains to be seen. Bob Dylan has a great song, and the line goes, "Stuck inside a mobile with those Memphis blues again." And that's what I think of as I look at this report, that the wannabe president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, crossed the border out of Venezuela to launch the humanitarian aid. And yesterday I was talking to Swami Beyondananda, and he authorized me to steal this line that, vegetarians eat vegetables, and therefore it's logical that humanitarians eat humans. And the humanitarian aid promised by the United States, therefore, can be rejected by Venezuela. You get the joke, right? So, when Guaido passed into Colombia last Friday, he defied a court order prohibiting him from leaving the country. And now he has popped up in Sao Paulo, Brazil, looking for a little love from Bolsonaro, who is the new strongman leader of Brazil. And now Guaido is in a pickle. Nicolas Maduro, the actual president of Venezuela, has suggested that Guaido will be arrested if he returns. He will have to face justice, and justice prohibited him from leaving the country. We'll be watching this one. I want to credit the World Socialist website and our pal, the media professor at NYU, Mark Crispin Miller. Miller sends out news articles every day, and he has been talking about the blackout on the massive auto worker strike by the affecting the maquiladoras in northern Mexico. And Ford Motor Company has had to stop production on some of its assembly lines near Detroit because they don't have enough steering wheels to put on the new cars. And World Socialist website deserves credit for covering this strike, which has been blacked out by the corporate media in this country until yesterday, when the Detroit Free Press and News finally reported on it. And the speculation in the socialist community is that Ford and the United Auto Workers were afraid that if the strike was publicized in the United States, that American workers might follow the calls from the Mexican counterparts to join their strike. And one professor over at UC Berkeley, Harley Shaken, said these strikes underscore how highly integrated the supply lines are. Most customers prefer steering wheels. So when you get this kind of disruption, it can paralyze production across North America. Yesterday in the House, there was a vote, and it was successful. They passed the Bipartisan Background Checks Act, which is probably going nowhere in the U.S. Senate. But the Republicans successfully staged a procedural vote under a rule called a motion to recommit, and it led many Democrats to vote for that procedural motion, which will enable the Republicans to use that vote against the Democrats at the next election. And this exposes a disarray between Speaker Pelosi and her Majority Leader Steny Hoyer and Whip James Clyburn. Hoyer believes that people should be able to vote against bills like this as long as it doesn't affect the outcome so that they can protect themselves from attacks at future elections. We'll see who wins this internal struggle. And the Republican effort to pack the courts continues apace. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed Eric Miller of Seattle as a judge on what used to be the most liberal appeals court, the Ninth Circuit, based here in San Francisco. And this is another evisceration of longstanding policy where the senator from a home state of a nominee is essentially allowed to blackball that potential nomination. And neither senator of Washington State approved the nomination of Eric Miller, and the Senate rammed through his confirmation before any Republicans could defect. The St. Bob Mueller investigation has admitted they made a mistake, and they filed a heavily redacted memo in Washington today admitting that they misstated to the court some issues that have been clarified by Paul Manafort, who was, of course, briefly the campaign chairman, and his longtime sidekick, whose name is Rick Davis. And Davis apparently gave a new interview to Mueller's team, clarifying the interactions with Konstantin Kilimnik, who is left as the only potential conspirator that we can see publicly in the Trump-Russia investigation, who might be able to show the kind of linkage that the Rachel Maddow fans have been hyperventilating about for several years now. So it's all redacted. We don't know enough of the details, but an admission of this kind of a mistake by Mueller is rare and newsworthy. Now, I had a little whiplash this morning because as I read my San Francisco Chronicle, it reported that the rogue utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, is fighting back against allegations that they were responsible for the brutal wildfire that destroyed the town of Paradise, California, and killed 86 people last November. Now, the whiplash comes because the New York Times headlines, PG&E says it probably caused the fire that destroyed Paradise, California. Well, the Chronicle has corrected its errant story from the print edition online in the last few hours. But this shows that PG&E is being dragged, kicking and screaming, into accepting its responsibility for causing these fires. And the truth came out in an earnings call where the company reported that it's taking a $10.5 billion charge in anticipation of damage claims from the campfire that devastated Paradise last fall. So I want to let you know that later this week, or by Monday at the latest, I will have the audio from a TV interview that I taped last weekend where we argue for the public takeover of Pacific Gas and Electric. That'll be coming your way very soon here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. This podcast is free, and you're free to share it far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube, and I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.